You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 5th to the 11th of March 2015. It's a bit of an election hustings special this week, but you'll be delighted to hear we also have our regular book section rundown coming up soon. Karen is celebrating as I say that on my left. That's coming up later. But first, on the 2nd of March, Times Higher Education teamed up with the Open University, Universities UK and the Higher Education Policy Institute to host the 2015 General Election Higher Education Hustings. We had the Minister for Universities, Science and Cities, Greg Clark. We had Labour Shadow Minister for Universities and Skills, Liam Byrne, and Lib Dem Science spokesman Julian Hubbard in attendance to debate the HE issues of the day. John Gill, as editor, I should come to you first, I guess. It was an important event, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's really important that higher education is talked about prior to the election. And I think back to sort of the period maybe, 6 months ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, when it looked as though higher education probably wouldn't be a big election issue. And it definitely is. We were incredibly lucky with the timing of the hustings. Well, lucky, or did we plan it? It was lucky. With Ed Miliband announcing the £6,000 tuition fee policy, which has been a long time coming, but, you know, didn't actually come out until, Thursday last week, so a couple of days before our event. So we had that and all sorts of other issues, as well as the funding point, you know, the fact that there's a renewed look at sort of extremism and the role that universities may or may not play in the radicalisation of young people. Another really big issue that's likely to play a big part in some of the discussions ahead of the election, which involves higher education, and was kind of up for grabs on Monday night. So yeah, it was a really good event, and it was very enlightening to have all three of them on the panel.
Yeah, I mean, it was 500 people in the room. We were trending UK-wide, not to blow our own trumpet too much, because there were some genuinely sort of interesting stories coming out of that debate. John, Morgan, you sort of covered a few of them online, and our splash this week sort of, you know, is in a similar policy area. Lots about Labour's 6K policy on Monday night. As John said, it was timed in a way that was going to mean that was always going to be the case.
Yeah, not surprisingly, given it was the first opportunity for the three parties to lock horns after that announcement. And Liam Byrne for Labour, his main tactic was to sort of really go on the attack against the current system and make the argument for Labour's 6K by saying that the status quo is not an option, there has to be change because the current financing system the coalition's introduced is going bust. And he would also accuse the Tories a couple of times of secretly planning to raise fees after the election because they haven't been upfront about what they would do, is his argument, by contrast to Labour having unveiled their policy in quite clear terms. And for Greg Clark, his response was to call Labour's policy unprogressive because it has benefits for the richest graduates. But it was perhaps surprising that Greg Clark didn't go harder on the attack. I mean, at one stage he said, "I'm sorry we've ended up with a disagreement on this," which is quite a very gentle, very nice way of putting it, but it could have been seen as a real opportunity for him to give Labour and Byrne a real savaging on stage and demolish the credibility behind their policy. But maybe that's just not the kind of politician that Greg Clark is. Maybe he genuinely is as nice as he seems to be.
It was a real clash of styles, wasn't it, with Liam Byrne sort of, you know, going very, you know, coming across very much as a sort of heavy hitting, you know, aggressive politician, you know, really. And actually, he won over when we did a show of colours. There were cards on the chairs of the people attending, and a couple of times throughout the night, the audience were asked to kind of vote on who they thought was getting the upper hand in the debate. And it was generally felt that Liam Byrne's more sort of, you know, going on the front foot seemed to come across better. I think Greg Clark was accused of filibustering at one point by the chair, Martha Lane Fox, and he then proceeded to do more of the same, was the general consensus.
I think you could see that Liam Byrne is the most experienced politician of them all and has the most ministerial experience, and perhaps also see that Greg Clark has to split his time between two completely different briefs as cities minister and universities and science. Yeah. So he's not got the same focus on his brief, perhaps, no. that Liam Byrne does.
And maybe that the Tories have decided it's not a big battleground for them ahead of the election, and that they want to, you know, try and be uncontroversial on higher education rather than get involved in too much of a skirmish over this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you can follow all the issues from the hustings in our online piece, which you'll find at timeshighereducation.co.uk. Chris Havergal also has a second article from those hustings on page 7 of this week's magazine and on that website. And John, one more word finally from you. In the aftermath of the debates, you grabbed a bit of time with Liam Byrne, and he said some interesting things to you about the future perhaps for access.
So access was one of the main things that I talked about with Liam Byrne. What would Labour's £6,000 fee policy mean for the access regime in the sector?
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, the Office for Fair Access, it and universities have to reach access agreements for how the universities will encourage applications from disadvantaged students,
mm-hmm.
if the universities are to get permission to charge above £6,000. Mm-hmm. And those access agreements are sort of notionally funded by the portion of the fee above £6,000. So if you go to a £6,000 fee, that raises the big question, what's going to happen to offer? And I put that to Liam Byrne, and his response was that Labour would reboot access strategy, and asked him if that meant scrapping offer. And he said, we're not ruling anything out, we're not ruling anything in. And he suggested that there were sort of bigger things that Labour's looking at in terms of the right way of delivering access in a world where fees are set at 6k, where we have ambitions to send apprentices to university in a bit much bigger way. So I think the Office for Fair Access might be looking at that with some concern about the future, and have some real questions about what would happen to them under a Labour 6k policy, because it sounds like Labour is saying that it's got very different ambitions on access to the current government.
Very much a watch this space issue, something that we will no doubt do in the coming weeks and months. On to something completely different. Well, not completely different. It's in the same magazine. It's our books section.
It's also hiring. In English, also involves academics.
Indeed, it's very similar, in fact. Karen Shook, our books editor, is here. What do we have this week?
This week's book of the week is The Undersea Network by Nicole Staroselsky, who is an American academic in the Department of Media, Culture and Communications at NYU. She wanted to study the nature of communication, and one of her academic advisors suggested working on satellite systems that include undersea cables. Now, this is someone who's largely from a humanities background, and Staroselsky said, those are old and boring, why would I do that? Fast forward a little bit, and we've got a fascinating book about all those places in the world where undersea cables meet land. Not all of them, because there were many she couldn't get to, but places in the South Pacific. And you would be surprised at all of the network that exists and the things that need to be taken into consideration. They're an advance on the Victorian cable routes, but obviously reaching far more places. There's some fantastic photos of, well, on the cover and elsewhere, of desolate beaches with these giant snake-like cables coming out. So even though it's very much a 21st century infrastructure, they do look a bit Victorian, actually. They look like something that could have come out of the Quatermass Chronicles.
It reminds me, I wrote when JISC launched Janet 6, the data network that connects all the UK's universities so they can send huge files much more quickly than we can, which is, from my experience of my internet connection at home, probably a blessing. But it led me to look into sort of the other cables that are around. It's amazing. The sort of cable goes from the UK to the US. I mean, that's they've been there for years as well. Quite an undertaking.
And have to be looked after. And in fact, some of the old decommissioned ones have been used to build reefs, artificial reefs for wildlife. She also addressed this issue in a digital project called Surfacing. Now, so we have a monograph on one side and a giant whizzy groovy, up-to-date digital project. So I said, surely a monograph is outdated. Why didn't you just do this kind of digital installation? And she said, if she's being honest, she reckons her book will remain in the library longer than this piece will remain online. Also this week, we have a review of a book called Against the Troika, Crisis and Austerity in the Eurozone. Pretty quick, actually, the day after the Greek elections, book to be published digitally by Verso. The USP here is that it's written by a German and a Greek, a German who was vice minister of finance in Germany and a professor of economics at SOAS, who is also a Syriza MP. So in that, they examine the relevant issues and give some clues as to what Syriza is approaching. But the rapprochement between the German and Greek approach that everyone's desperately looking for is actually already here in this book. John Barber at King's College Cambridge looks at a book on the crisis in the Ukraine. He's a noted expert on the Ukraine, as is the author Richard Sakwa. In brief, things aren't looking jolly. Danny Dorling, noted geographer and author of Inequality and the 1%, frequent contributor to our pages, reviews a book this week called Rebel Footprints, A Guide to Uncovering London's Radical History, and he draws some comparisons to the family life of the young Milibands and all the figures that could be found in their family home, and then the sort of people that Emmeline and Richard Pankhurst's daughters grew up, where they got to know William Morris and Peter Kropotkin, amongst others. You can still trace those paths of radical paths in London. If you ever wondered why people on trains were not having sufficiently philosophically rigorous conversations, you might want to direct them to Timothy Williamson's new book, a very eminent philosopher who has looked at the dialogue format, which was in the charts, philosophically speaking, in ancient Greece, not troubling the scores too much since then. He suggested that you can look at disagreement by this tetralogue that he's set up, four kind of straw men characters looking at different positions, very instrumentalist, very essentialist, and have them have an argument. I have never encountered a train carriage like this. However, Katerina Noves at the University of Groningen looks at this and can only commend its approach to talking about discussions. He doesn't explore what happens if this is done at, you know, midnight on a Friday night when everyone's two sheets to the wind.
Indeed. You mentioned Danny Dorling there. He's obviously, as well as being a contributor, took part in one of your wonderful books podcasts. You'll find that in our podcast section. There's quite a few of those now, and I understand there's some more coming up, but we'll...
And he's written an opinion piece this week about the £6,000 fee policy.
Fantastic. It's good how these things come together. It's not like we planned it. So speaking of other podcasts, in fact, there is a second podcast in the next 7 days. On Wednesday, our reputation rankings come out, 9 p.m. UK time. So you'll find all of the tables on our ranking site, www.thewur.com. We'll take you there. You can go to the Times Higher Ed site though as well, and there'll be plenty of links. Before we go to the cover feature we haven't mentioned this week, five vice chancellors write about how they view their role and what advice they'd offer to aspiring university leaders, and indeed some tips for just surviving at the top, I think, John. What's it all about?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of those jobs, isn't it? It's a bit like being a football manager. Everyone thinks they could run the university better than the man or woman, probably man, who is running the university. And we've actually asked five, is it five? Yeah, five, mm-hmm. to give us their sort of very individual takes on what it's like. And it's partly sort of passing on advice to other people that might aspire to the role, partly sort of shedding light on what it's actually like for those of us outside it. And really, really interesting. I mean, David Eastwood at Birmingham, one of the sort of most senior vice-chancellors, I would say, in the sector, has written a fascinating first piece where he likens it to the role of the conductor leading an orchestra, and some interesting pieces from various people. We end up with an anonymous vice-chancellor survival guide written by a former VC, which is great, actually, and it really... I could read any of these points. That there's probably 20 points here listed under getting started, getting going, and getting out, and they're all very funny, but also with, you know, a real sense of truth to them. Getting out, he says, you will have been a disappointment. This outcome comes with a cast iron guarantee. And his next point is, the person appointed to replace you will be your diametric opposite. they too will be a disappointment.
On that note, you can read that full article in this week's magazine on timeshighereducation.co.uk as well. Click the features tab. That's all for this week's podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed or indeed any articles in the magazine, you can do so by contacting us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, all the places you'd expect. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.